C2A. Number 22B.
In that unity, we come to a point of soul. Again, when we come to point of soul, one makes a definite shift from sense to soul, a complete transformation from sense to soul. You see at once that the paragraph has to do with soul, actually always with love demonstrating truth at the point of principle. So we don't have to lose that out of sight. The meek demonstrator of good. Can you see? The demonstrator principle, but the meek, the humble, the third beatitude. Blessed are the meek. Those who subjugate themselves under principle. The meek demonstrator of good, the highest instructor and friend of men, met his earthly fate, how? Alone with God. Now you have the only oneness and unity that is infallible, our oneness with God. God never forsakes us. No human eye, that's the counterfeit again of principle, the human eye was there to pity, no arm to save. Forsaken by all. Do you hear the tone again, the counterfeit of principle? Forsaken by all whom he had blessed. This faithful sentinel of God at the highest post of power, charged with the grandest trust of heaven, was ready to be transformed. Do you hear the tone of soul? Was ready to make that transition from sense to soul, just as we had it in the subject before, in soul as soul. We had the same way that he turned away forever from sense to soul. Here it is again. He was now ready to make the demonstration to be transformed by the renewing of the infinite spirit. He was to prove, principle, that the Christ is not subject to material conditions, but is above. Soul is always that which is supreme and stands above everything, above the reach of human wrath, the counterfeit of love, and is able through truth, life and love to triumph over sin, sickness, death and the grave. If we would take it very slowly and analyze it, you could see in that paragraph so nicely the tone of love as the main tone, namely at the highest demonstration, as truth demonstrating really the triumph over sin, sickness and death. But how does man do that? He does it through principle, namely through his unity with God, which never forsakes, and does it through soul, namely by being willing to be transformed by the renewing of infinite spirit. So all what you have to do is to take that text at home a bit slower than I do now. Now I don't want to pinpoint everything. Now I want to see if we can read quicker and just hear the music, so to say, of it. So again, we have that sense of principle, our principle as soul, principle to be forsaken, though he had been blessing all those many people. They forsook him, and so he was ready to say, all right, then I turn away from sense, I turn away from peopleianity, and go right back to my Father. You know, that was so impressive in Dolly's time, this sentence, forsaken by all. For an idealistic student of that time, it was just unbelievable that such a thing could happen. When one was sitting in his class association, as long as he was a teacher, I still have the atmosphere of those class associations. They were something terrific. They were so terrific that one lived from it for a whole year, just by that atmosphere, perhaps not even remembering so much what he has said, but that terrific atmosphere. Every student was very, very proud. Proud is not a good thing, but they were proud to be a student of John Dorley. And when the whip cracked in Boston, they were nowhere anymore. They just disappeared. And there was just left a handful of faithful students who somehow have seen, perhaps only spiritually, without really understanding it, that was not necessary, but to see that he was really doing something in the 6,000-year period what Jesus did in another field in the 5,000-year period, namely that he was charged with the grandest trust of heaven. That we could see. That he was charged with the grandest trust of heaven. And one would feel to be a real Judas, a traitor, if one would flee and run away. He too could say, well, that he has saved others. He had saved so many. All those students that were sitting in association, most of them had a wonderful healing. All of them were blessed. There is no gratitude. There is no human gratitude. We can't build on that. Can't build on that. It's quite amazing what animal magnetism can do to the human mind, which it can't do to the divine mind. So if we base ourselves in the divine mind and see that divine mind as a spiritual reality and spiritual substance, we free ourselves of having a Judas within ourselves. And then we will stick to the right idea. I go on to the next subtone of principle as principle, and you see at once that the tone changes. The priests and rabbis, again the counterfeit of principle, before whom he had meekly walked, just shows back to that meek demonstrator, and those to whom he had given the highest proof of divine power, to whom he had given the highest proof, he proved through his life, and everybody could see it with her eyes, mocked him on the cross, saying derisively, he saved others, himself he cannot save. This is a question that comes to every pioneer when he goes through the transition and is ready to be transformed, that he always has a sense, can I make it? Will I make it? I'm alone. Nobody will help me. Can I make it alone? And so he has always that question coming to him. Others, he could help. He could save others. Am I able now to help myself? Can I save myself? Will I do it? Without having anybody sustaining him and being forsaken by all. Just standing alone with God. And that's a healthy state of things. These scoffers who turned aside the right of a man before the face of the Most High esteemed Jesus as stricken, smitten of God. Think of that situation. There he was on the cross, and the rabbis just sneering at it and say, now you got it, huh? Now you got it, huh? You thought that you can help everybody, but you can't help yourself. Why don't you come down from the cross, they asked. Why don't you come down? This is an easy thing for you to do. You have done much higher proofs than that. Much higher demonstration than that. Why can't you just come down? Nobody's around anymore. They said he is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before the shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. He didn't say a thing. He didn't say a thing to Pilate, nor did he say a thing on the cross, and said, no use of talking with you, of arguing with you. You are just as dumbness can be, so why should I argue with you? You have not the light of mind, so it's no use to arguing. In science, we can't argue with people that do not want to see science. We can't. There must first be that inner desire that longs to see science as a science. And if that longing is not there, it's no use to argue. I never argue with those who don't want to see science. It's hopeless. One only spends a lot of energy and time, that's all. So, the question was, who shall declare his generation? Jesus' generation. Isn't it an interesting question after the cross and about asking he is brought as a lamb to the slaughter? Why then that question, who shall declare his generation? Jesus' generation. What is Jesus' generation? Jesus' generation was always that generating order of mind to spirit, to soul, to principle, to life, to truth, and to love. That was his generation. That was that which he wanted to demonstrate. He wanted to demonstrate God and not to come down from the cross. Can you see, he had a completely different concept of demonstrating science than the other people had. It's still that same thing today, that the old way of thinking still asks other questions than the scientists, those instructed in the science of Christian Science, ask. The student of Christian Science asks, what is my generation? What shall I demonstrate as my generation? And as my generation is my evolution of man that has one goal, namely to see that we have but one mind, that one mind is only spirit, that only spirit is infinitely identified spiritually and not corporeally, that spirituality is under the impact of a principle that I want to demonstrate. That principle is spiritual and not corporeal. I want to demonstrate not the science of physical harmony. I want to demonstrate the science of spiritual harmony, which leads me to the one life, so that I can demonstrate life in and of spirit and not life in and of the human, that I go further to truth, and I think what I want to demonstrate is that man is purely idea, that I come to that awareness, to that conscious communion with the fact that man is nothing but idea. I have to work that through until I get it, until I touch it spiritually. And that is what I work on, and what we work on, and what Mrs. Eddy asks us to work on. So that we find that the idea man at the point of love is an idea that blesses the universe, that saves the universe, not me, the universe. So that is declaring our generation. So we can see that they were asking for a sign in the old paradigm, in the old paradigm of the signs of physical harmony. But Jesus was working out a new generation, a new paradigm, namely working out really the science of spiritual harmony. And those two paradigms do not coincide. They never understand each other. So we come to the last point about this oneness with God, namely the tone of principle as life, that principle which says, I'm one with God, and that has to be proved as one life, or it's only a theory. So he had to go a step further than principle as principle, and had to prove it as life, as one life, namely to prove that his unity is that the life of God is the same life as the life of men. That he had then to prove. And this he did, and it is shown here in the next paragraph, namely, the last supreme moment of mockery, desertion, torture, you get the whole sense of that soul, the opposite of soul, that last supreme moment of mockery added to an overwhelming sense of the magnitude of his work. Can you see the both sides of it? On one side, the gloomy picture of the mockery about Jesus, about what he was standing for. On the other side, Jesus knew in his heart that he is going to make a demonstration of greatest magnitude, that this is a world moment at that point, that the world will be changed, not only he. That rung from Jesus' lips the awful cry, "My God, hast thou forsaken me?" Well, it doesn't seem to be a true statement, such a cry from Jesus' lips at that highest moment. And actually, the older Bibles, like the Aramaic Bible, doesn't translate it this way, but says, "My God, for this thou hast chosen me." For this thou hast... just a moment. My God, for this I was spared. For this I was spared. Meaning, for this demonstration I was chosen, was elected to do it. So it wasn't really a sense of being forsaken. And Mrs. Eddy didn't know that at that time, because at that time she didn't have a translation from the Aramaic. But she felt that something was wrong about that sentence. So her interpretation is according really to the tonality of the Aramaic translation. Namely, she says, "This despairing appeal, if made to a human parent, not to the divine parent, would impugn the justice and love of a father who could forehold a clear token of his presence to sustain and bless such a faithful son." Can you see how cleverly, really, she gets around that statement? She couldn't easily say, well, Jesus can't have said that, because that would have brought theology right on the tree. Huh? They would climb the palms, really, as we say. Do you say that too, climbing the palms? No? When you go up the wall? Oh, you go up the wall. Yeah, we do both. We go up the wall and we climb the palm tree. So she couldn't say that and say, well, Jesus didn't say that. So she would have the opposition of theology. But she felt something was wrong, that such an appeal could only be made to human parents. And even to human parents, this would not be true. Even the human parents would not forsake. So, she corrects it and says, the appeal of Jesus was made both to his divine principle, the God who is love, and to himself, love's pure idea. Had life, truth, and love forsaken him in his highest demonstration? And you see, she doesn't believe that he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? She says, could really life, truth, and love forsake him in his highest demonstration? Is it impossible? This was a startling question. No. No. She says, no. And now she becomes definite and says, I don't believe that theological stuff. No. They must abide in him and he in them. Can you see that wonderful sense of unity, of at-one-ment, off with the idea man and his divine principle, and that could not be forsaken. So they must abide in him and he in them, or that hour would be shorn of its mighty blessing for the human race. Again, the tone of the plan of love that wanted to bring out, that has selected Jesus, that had spared Jesus for one big demonstration to demonstrate principle life, to demonstrate that man is one with principle and that that principle is life. Not people have life, but principle is life. And that's the end of this tonality of principle. Can you see what we are considering at this tone of principle? It is showing us, really, is there an atonement of man with the idea man and its divine principle? Can that be demonstrated or not? So principle, the fourth stage, says yes. How do you demonstrate that? It says, look out. The very first thing is that you know what God can do for man. That you know, and that it is actually only ignorance that makes you believe that you can be forsaken by God and the idea. It's only a belief. Therefore, change that belief into the knowledge of divine mind. We said there, what did it say about mind? That the true knowledge of God, that's necessary to see, and that is one with man. At the point of spirit, she would say and show that naturally you have to value what you see in mind, that you have to value, be grateful for that unity. If you are not grateful, then your heart goes away from it. And if your heart goes away into another direction, you lose your conscious unity with the oneness of the oneness with God. So your heart must be there. Therefore, not just thinking that way or knowing that way, your whole heart must go along with it. And so at that point comes in the touch of soul. So it said, if you turn and are willing to turn completely from a way and are ready to be transformed, then all the malignity of human intention, mortal, worldly thought can no more touch you. That the world's thought can no more hinder you that demonstration. But there must be within you that sense of soul that is willing to surrender, that is willing really to be transformed. It demands that meekness, that humbleness of thought. If we do that, then we can, at the point of principle as principle, make principle's own demonstration, not people's demonstration. Not the demonstration that said, come down from the cross, but that we can make that demonstration which principle has foreseen for us. This is always a great question. We would like to make those demonstrations which we humanly have perceived or conceived, whereas principle says, I'm going to make that demonstration with you which I, principle, want to make. And you better bend your knees. And then comes in that little touch of life, which says, and you know, if you are demonstrating the principle the way principle wants to demonstrate itself, then you can be quite sure that your life will be preserved, that God is not going to forsake you. And so, therefore, your life will be preserved. That's the tone of principle. Yeah. There's only 2 or 3 minutes left. I don't want to start with the next tone of life. Let's just always remember, see, that's what I said, a method and a rule of text interpretation that we should use very often. That every time we have made a new step, that we look backward and say, what has gone before, what was really happening. For instance, see, in order to remember what happened, one can also somehow stick to the symbolism that there was shown. For instance, we saw in this whole picture of love as truth, working out really what is man, the first scenery, so to say, was the scenery of the disciples meeting Jesus after the resurrection, talking with him, and going down to Emmaus with him, and being touched by the Word of God. So we see that first scenery we can keep in mind. The second tone of spirit was all about that scenery which says, how did Jesus step by step turn away from matter to spirit? First through the period after the resurrection, having a body that did not really confine spirit, that did not hinder spirit to be spirit, was no hindrance to spirit anymore. That period after the resurrection, then the ascension, where Jesus left the material sense of things, he could no more be seen, and finally the Holy Ghost and the days of Pentecost. So you have there and spirit, that scenery of those three steps. Can you see? If you go to soul, the scenery changed, and it was all about Judas and about the betrayal. A whole tone of soul. The moment Mrs. Eddy wanted to bring out principle, how Jesus demonstrated principle, she changed the scenery again and showed Calvary, Jesus on the cross. How did it prove that stage? And you see, so the next subject will be again something similar, but in another circumstance. What is the cross? What is the real cross of Jesus? And we'll see the symbol of the cross, what that means. In this way, you can also somehow entertain the flow of the subject much easier. Have you ever thought about that when you were 10, 20 years ago reading the textbook? It was all upside down. The cross and the resurrection and the Emmaus and the morning meal and the breakfast and so on, the Last Supper and so on, everything. And when you analyze the text through tonality, suddenly you begin to see it's a very ordered presentation. Everything falls in order. Okay, make a break.